Well, the big story in South African business circles over the last month has been the judgment against what the judge Denise Fisher called the protagonists of Dimension Data, led by its chairman or co-founder, former chairman, Jeremy Ord. I think there's been two sides to every story, and there certainly are there as well. But today's conversation adds some very interesting insights into the way that the protagonists operate. You'll get to see perhaps another side that might influence the way the judgment was delivered. Well, it's a warm welcome to Jerry Komnenos, who is still based in Johannesburg, still working, and Graham Roy, who is already on holiday at the coast, and that's why we don't see him on screen, for those of you who are watching. Graham, nice to have you with us as well. It's a heck of a story. Thank you for sharing it with me. You guys have been at, taking on the protagonist. You've been to court. It's cost you a lot of money, at least initially. Then they settled. Well, not they settled, but the Japanese who own Dimension Data settled. So you got presumably your legal fees back. You can never get those 3 years of your life back that it involved in. But maybe, Jerry, as you're on screen, just give us some background. You guys are the co-owners of what's called the Rand View Data Center. What exactly is that?
And Alec, Graham and I purchased a vacant plot somewhere around 2000, 2001. I can't remember exactly. And we established a township and we developed a township. We put in all the infrastructure and we sold off bits of land. And we, at that time, we were approached by Xerox, a division of Xerox called Laser Facilities. And we entered into an agreement with them for an 8-year lease to build them what was probably a forerunner of future data centers. They were a company that produced all the invoices, hard copy invoices for all banks, Woolworths, those sort of corporates. And it was a data center. It had 800 square meters of a data center area, a hub, and then it also had the output section where they produced their invoice, their paper invoices. At the end of that lease,
So I was going to just ask Graham. Graham, exactly where is this in Randburg, Graham?
It's in Malabongwe, across the road from Home Affairs. Everybody knows the area well. If you know Home Affairs in Randburg, across the road is Randview Business Park, which is the whole business park that we developed back in the day.
And it's the data center in that business park that you guys own.
Correct. So it was a building that we built for Xerox as a data center. And after the lease was up, they left. And
Jerry, what happened then after Xerox left?
Well, what happened after that, they left the building in a bit of a state. And so we spent a little bit more than 6-7 months refurbishing the building, getting it up to scratch again. And at that time, we were approached by Didata. And they said they were looking for a data center in the Randburg area. We presumed it was because they needed a different electrical grid. We weren't quite sure of their motives. But they gave us a whole list of parameters that we had to comply with before they would sign a lease with us. So we duly did that. It was about the zoning of the property, the size. There was a whole lot of due diligence stuff that they wanted done, and then we complied. And they approached us and they said, look, we'd really like to lease your site from you, but we would need to make some changes and to suit our particular needs, but your building fits the bill. So we said, okay, that's fine. And we entered into negotiations with them. One of their primary objectives was to get a period, a sort of a rent holiday, a period where they had time to alter the building to suit their needs, and also to start populating the data center with their customers. And we eventually signed a 10-year lease with them with a 5-year renewal period. And they then proceeded to upgrade the existing data center into something far more sophisticated than they actually let on initially. And it actually became their flagship data center. It was highly sophisticated at the time, in any case, and it had green technology and a whole lot of other features, which they obviously attempted to, or they did attract a lot of customers due to that. So,
and
they were very good tenants. I mean, they paid us on time for 10 years. There wasn't a problem until the renewal period came along, and that's when we started butting heads with Didata's personnel, and that's when things went a little bit south for us. In any case,
Graham, how big is this data center?
Jerry, what's it? I don't know the exact figures. It's 4,000.
It's a plus minus 4,000 square meters, and it can house 650 racks.
So, yeah. just for those of us who don't really know, help us. How many rugby fields would that be, or just give us an idea of how much space that is?
It's about an acre.
About an acre. All right. So it's a proper.
Yes. So the total building is about an acre, but there's obviously offices and ancillary areas that you know, that support the actual rack area. At the time, I did a quick estimate at the time, and by the time the renewal came along, it represented over 60% of Didata's total rack stock. So we were quite a significant data center until, of course, they built Joburg 1 in Midrand, which is their first phase, as far as I can remember, was more or less the same size as the Randview data center, the Randview Business Park data center.
I think what makes it unique as a data center is people wonder, why can't you just build a data center anyway? Well, you can't, because it's all about power. What was very important is Jerry and I had developed the whole suburb, and that suburb, we knew how to get power. So they needed a dedicated 6 MVA of power. Now, that's huge. 6 MVA is the average 2 or 3 suburbs of a normal residential area. And we managed to get that as dedicated power so that they've got clean power, so they have no interruption. So I think that was one of the criteria that was so important to Didata.
Okay, so fast forward then to 2019. We know from the judgment that at that stage there was a management buyout attempt by Jeremy Ord and what the judge called the protagonists. And right around this time, the lease was now coming up for renewal.
Yes.
So there does appear to have been some kind of a overlap there. Can you tell us exactly what happened at that time? Because this is pretty much the crux of the story.
This is when it gets interesting. So we Jerry and I, you know, we would like them to stay on for the further 5 years. They had an option of renewal. And we thought we would enter into normal negotiations, as most businessmen do. So we prepared for a meeting. We set up at the data center. And that's when we, you know, met up. We walked into the boardroom, and we were met up with a guy called Sean Seeliger. And his partner is Martin Epstein. Now, he came into this meeting and duly introduced himself. And I'll say word for word, he says, "I'm Jeremy Ord's private property portfolio representative." We said, "Well, excuse me, why are we talking to you? We're here to negotiate an extension of a lease with Dimension Data." He said he has a full mandate from the board to represent Dimension Data, but you claiming to represent Jeremy Ord's private property portfolio. He says, yes, that's how it's going to work, and they're going to buy the building from us, buy it or rent it from us, And if we don't sell it to them, they will force us to sell. And then he then grabbed the lease that we had and he threw it at us across the table. I've never had a lease thrown at me in a business meeting. And he said, our building is worth nothing. And he says, you know, best we sell the building or give them a reasonable rent. And Jerry, what else can you remember on that meeting?
Well, I mean, we were all there at the meeting. I think the surprising thing was that the CEO at the time, Julian Sunker, was also in the meeting, and he didn't say a word. The only person speaking at the time was Sean Seeliger, and I think what he proposed, he said he'd done a valuation or a preliminary valuation. And he didn't think our building was worth much, and they were going to be offering us actually a rent lower than the one they were already paying. And we then referred him to the lease, and then he said, yeah, he's read the lease, and I think that's when he threw it across the table, but he said our building is not worth it, and if we don't accept the rent that they're proposing, they would just buy the building from under us. They would force us to sell to them. At that point in the meeting, I just said to Graham, I mean, we'd prepared. We had a whole lot of options available for the rent renewal in terms of the lease. I said, there's no point in carrying on. There's obviously a huge problem here, and we'd have to revert back to the mechanism within the lease, which would help us resolve this impasse. And this was also quite an important part of the lease renewal, and that lease renewal stated that if the landlord and the tenant at the time of renewal could not agree on a lease, on a rent amount, each of the parties would employ their own valuers to determine a market-related rent for a data center at that point of time. Remembering now, we'd given them their rental holiday, and we'd actually They'd spent quite a lot of money on the building. And we warned them during this time. We said, look, guys, at the rent renewal, remember, we're going to determine the rent based on the market value of the building. Well, they seemed to ignore that, but it all came out when we spoke to Seeliger, and it was quite clear they were not going to pay us according to the rent. And so we reverted back to the lease, where we both got valuations. We both got our own valuers. There were specific criteria to appoint those valuers. And they came out with to our mind, was a completely lowball offer. In the event that the valuations didn't agree and the valuers had a meeting and couldn't agree on what the renewal rent should be, then each valuation would be added together and divided by two. In other words, it would be the average of the two valuations. So we got our valuer to do a valuation, a very well-known valuer in valuation circles. In fact, he's now a professor and works for one of the large corporate property companies. And he had a meeting with their valuers and said, look, guys, how did you arrive at your figure?
What were the figures? Can you not tell us the figures so we can understand better?
Yeah, okay. So their figure was, they valued the building as such as a valuation of the building at 34 million, and they wanted to pay us a rent of 231,000 rand a month, more or less. Was that right, Graham? 230?
That's correct. Yeah, 34 million. Yeah. That's correct. And we valued it at 311 million.
Whoa.
No, so there was quite a huge, and I think the important thing, it wasn't about the valuation of the building. It was a valuation about what rent should be paid. And so they valued it at their valuer came in and said the rent that should be paid is 231. And our valuer came in and said the rent should be 4 million a month. And the reason for the discrepancy was that they had, in our opinion, their valuers had jiggled it a little bit to not take into account it was a data center and not use the proper methodology when valuing the data center. Whereas our valuer did in fact do that, and he used the document that's produced by the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors, used all over the world to value data centers. And that's why he came out at his value. It was essentially a trade-related value. As you would value a hotel or a hospital or something like that, it's not valued on the bricks and mortar. It's valued rather on the potential income that can be produced. Like a hotel is valued on the number of beds or keys that it has, or hospital on the number of beds. So in this particular case, the valuation was based on the potential to house 650 server racks or racks, which contained various servers. So there was obviously a big conflict in terms of how the valuers went about their business. And it just struck us once we got the judgment that we noticed there was also a valuation problem when they valued the campus. And it seems to us there was a similarity between the way they operated when they sold the campus and the way they were dealing with us. The meeting of the valuers, which was recorded, and we have the transcript of that, clearly indicated that the valuers that were representing Data were instructed by Data on how to value this building. They never contacted us. They never actually followed any methodology which took into account a data center as such. They merely valued a warehouse. And in fact, some of the affidavits that were submitted during the court case, the people that submitted the affidavits weren't even there at the time of the lease, signing of the lease, and purported to know the value of the building, et cetera, et cetera. It was just crazy the way that we were having to deal with the representatives of Data, their management, and so on and so forth. So this all came from when Sean Seeliger said that he was representing Jeremy Ord's private property interests. He did, in fact, give it the... Yeah.
Let's just understand this, Jerry. You've mentioned a court case. So now, just to rewind a little, you had the valuation in the 300-odd million. They had a valuation of one-tenth of that. What happens in a case like that? Can you not just say to them, look, we're not going to renew your lease, bugger off, we'll get somebody else to come in?
Well, they did have their choice to resile from the whole agreement. And in fact, our advocate went to their legal team and said to them, look, you can't force us to rent to you. You have a choice to resile from the agreement, but you chose not to. And in fact, they insisted on renewing the lease. That was never in dispute, that they wanted to renew the lease. The only thing in dispute was the amount that they should pay on a monthly basis. And so that was also very strange to us, that they insisted on this, because they had a choice to leave the facility. And in fact, our court case, we didn't
so you went to court
for the rent.
In other words, let's just so you then go to court on that. You've given us the parallels of what happened with the Judge Denise Fisher's whole judgment, and you went to court in a completely separate matter, as you've explained. And that was what, Graham, what you were saying, took 3 years of your life and 4 million rand in legal fees.
Yeah, correct. And then what's important is, this is Steve Nathan had a lot of correspondence with me as well. And he said to us, we will never comply with what the lease agreement says. And if you must remember, if not, we will see you in the Constitutional Court. Well, you know, I don't know. The bully boy tactics just went on and on and on. You know, a data center is not something somebody can pack up and go. You know, it's not like you can, it would take probably about 2 years to move out the building. But this is why they always knew they couldn't move out. And we were prepared to negotiate a reasonable lease. We were prepared to negotiate a reasonable rental, but they just came and strong-arm bully boy tactics, and exactly what they, by the looks of the judgment, exactly what they did there, where they were determined to get that building for Jeremy Ord's private income.
So the point that you make there about going all the way to the Constitutional Court, Jerry, that would suggest it was lawfare, as they call it, warfare using legal means.
Yeah, there's no doubt that it was lawfare. I mean, we were dealing with their legal team was Evershed, and on numerous occasions we objected to some of the tactics that they employed. We objected to what we considered to be false affidavits, because what the people that were writing the affidavits weren't even there when the lease was signed, and they had no knowledge of what the intent of the lease was at the time that it was signed. And so when we saw that there were blatant lies, to give you an example, one of the affidavits stated that when Didata took over our building, it was a single-story dilapidated warehouse. Now, first of all, there's a whole 1,000 square meters of double story, and it certainly wasn't dilapidated because we just spent 6 months refurbishing the building. It wasn't ideally suited to what they wanted, but it wasn't dilapidated. Those kind of statements just irked us, because it was clear that they wanted to stretch this thing out and make us pay as much as possible and hopefully wear us out. I mean, that was our opinion of their tactics, because so much of what they said was just nonsense, including their valuation. And when we spoke to the valuers, they just told us straight out that they didn't even bother to go and ask us or do a proper investigation as to how to value a data center. Basically, Didata had told them what to do. And this was also very surprising to us. But it was overall that over the 3 years, it wasn't a very pleasant experience to deal with corporate lawfare at this level. I mean, we're just small businessmen. We happened to land a very good lease with Didata, and then we somehow appeared to incur the wrath of their legal team and what they were demanding. And at the time, both Graham and I, we didn't call them the protagonists. We called them the Cabal. That was our nickname for them. And we were 100% convinced there was something behind this whole negotiation in inverted commas regarding the rent. Of course, at the time, nobody believed us. I mean, they all just looked, you know, what are you guys talking about? You're getting too emotional. You're talking nonsense, and you should just be happy with what you got, and you're too greedy, and this and that. And in the end, it was a very difficult time in our lives. It really was.
Yeah. What's important? Can I add to it there that what's important is a data center. Our Randview data center generated in excess of 50 million rand a month income for them. So you 30, yeah, income for them. So, I mean, it just showed you why these buildings are so valuable, is their potential earnings.
So you went to court and were fighting presumably in court, which could have been Stalingrad tactics. Sadly, in the South African legal system, you can drag these things out for years and years and years, and you're paying the lawyers all the way through. Where did it all come to a head? How did you manage to sort this out? And that's the reason. Had you been in the process of a legal suit now, we would not really be able to talk to you about this, because, you know, it's he said, she said, but you'd have come to a settlement. And I think that you need to explain to us. Graham, do you want to pick up?
Yeah. Well, I think what happened in the end, we gathered that there was more to this than what we were seeing. And we told them that we wanted to include in our court case the meeting of Jeremy Ord's wanting to buy this for private property portfolio. And at that stage, we then started to deal with NTT. And the new, we had been through about three or four CEOs of Dimension Data. They were in and out, like, we didn't even know who we were dealing with. The minute we started to deal with NTT, That's when things started to fall apart for them and come together for us. In the fact that we got to speak to some of the new managers at NTT Dimension Data, who were also seeing a picture of there's something not right here.
So let me just interject there. NTT is the Japanese company that bought Dimension Data, 100% of it, and owns Dimension Data. So you're talking now to a multinational corporation, not to Jeremy Ord and, the protagonists, as they've been mentioned in the court papers.
Yes. So the minute we started talking to, we had numerous meetings with different managers of NTT themselves. Sorry?
Yeah, we're hearing you. Carry on.
And once we started putting down our case straight to them. This is what was agreed. And we referred to what was agreed all those years ago when we built the building and signed the original lease. This is what was agreed, that we had a mechanism in place to work out a market-related rental. And that mechanism was very clear-cut. And we just want them to honor the agreement. And we initially went to court on papers, and then that was rejected. And we were ready to go to full trial in April this year, in fact. And out of the blue, we got a phone call to say, right, they're happy, they accept what we are claiming, and they've agreed to start paying a market-related rental. And that was it. You know, we've got no argument left of them. I mean, we're not dealing with people who understand that this is what an agreement is. It's in place, and they must just honor it.
Jerry, what is a market-related rental for a data center? Just so that we can understand what the protagonists were actually wanting to force you to charge them.
Well, I mean, it's a difficult one, Alec, and I'll tell you why it's difficult. Most of the people that build data centers, whether it's the architects, the engineers, the QSs, whoever's involved in it, the developer, they tend to sign non-disclosure agreements. So you can't go to a quantity surveyor and ask him, what does it cost to build a data center? You can only go on newspaper reports what they spent on it. To give you an idea, Joburg 1, phase 1, cost them R1 billion, NTT, R1 billion. We got a pretty good idea that that's more or less the figure for a data center of our size. So, and that's including all the groceries. And by groceries, I mean the server racks and all the other peripheral stuff that needs to go into a data center. So we understood that we hadn't provided that, and we were quite prepared to negotiate around those things. And so when it comes to valuing the data center, we were eventually left with a number of options, and we had to refer to the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors document, which tells you quite clearly, I think there are two or three methods to value a data center, but it's all dependent on a whole lot of other factors. Our valuer, Dr. Dobosov, he said this is a trade-related valuation, and he valued it based on the income that was generated by the number of servers. So to give you an idea, Graham mentioned a figure of $13 million a month, and that's based on invoices that Didata sends out to people that are renting servers or racks from Didata or any one of these type of data centers. So typically, Terraco or Terraco have got their own set of rates and per server, amount of electricity used, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So a server rack can cost you anywhere between 15,000, which is a very basic server rack. Is it server or server rack, Graham?
It's a server rack.
Server rack. So between that and up to even 50,000 rand a rack, depending on what services you're getting from the data center. So if you're trying to value a data center, you first have to work out what amount are they charging for the racks, and then there is a formula that the valuer is used in a trade related valuation to determine what that value is. I think it's 25%. I can't remember. Can you remember what it was, Graham?
Yeah, no, I can't.
But anyway, it's worth out in our particular case at somewhere between 3 and 4 million a month. But if you're netting a minimum of 13 million a month, you know, the figures just go crazy.
So if I understand this, and I think there's been a lot of detail, and thank you for all that. You had the misfortune of renegotiating your lease at a time that there was a proposed management buyout of Dimension Data. And that you were told by the representative of Dimension Data, one Sean Seelinger. What is he doing? Is he an independent? Seelinger. Is he an independent valuer?
He is an independent valuer. Apparently, yeah, he did have some sort of relationship with Jeremy Ord. I can't verify that or not verify it. But we know that the first lot of emails included Martin Epstein, as well as, you know, obviously the cabal and Sean Seelinger.
When you say the cabal, who's the cabal? Are these similar people to
that's the protagonist? It was quite strange that the judge also had a little name for them. Yes.
So Grant Bodley, people like Grant Bodley, who is the other one? Of course, Stephen Nathan.
Stephen Nathan, you'll see that the letter I've sent you.
Yeah, but it's signed in the letter as well from those. Are they still working there, Grant Bodley and Stephen Nathan? Does he still work for Dimension Data?
No, they all left pretty soon after. They were all moved on.
Okay, so
when we heard that they'd been I don't know, dismissed, or they'd been put on a paid holiday or whatever it was, we dealt with the guy called Werner Kapp. And then we thought, well, it's maybe prudent to write to Werner, because we're not sure if any of the information or the dealings we've had are common knowledge within Didata. We got the feeling that it was a very closed shop and it was kept strictly between the people we were dealing with. And so we wrote the letter to Werner Kapp, which outlined basically what we're telling you now. And at that time we knew there was a forensic investigation from the English legal firm. I can never remember their name. It's about three names mentioned in the judgment. Mm-hmm. And we thought, well, maybe we should tell Mr. Kapp, this is our experience at this moment in time, which might, you know, either reinforce their suspicions, because they were obviously suspicious that some fraud had been committed at that time, but it wasn't clear exactly what it was. And we were basically in the dark, playing our lawfare with Eversheds.
Just to understand this a little bit better, you were, from your description, you were being bullied, Graham, into paying 200,000 rand a month in rental to a organization that very clearly said that we act on behalf of Jeremy Ord, the co-founder of Didata. Is that what you're telling us?
And that's correct.
And the actual market-related rental was at least 10 times that from what Jerry has said a moment ago.
That is correct. And that was the cause of our 3-year court case.
So the court case is now over, Jerry. From what you've said, it would appear that NTT, the Japanese owners of Didata, who actually did not allow the management buyout, so everything's changed, that they will have this information and they might be using this information from your side to form an opinion, which is making them not allow the protagonists to walk away from the deal on the campus, but in fact that they want to pursue them. Is that a surprise to you?
No, not really. I must just say that the people that have replaced the protagonists in our relationship with Didata or NTT are fine guys. I mean, we at least could talk to them, and we got a settlement. And both Graham and I got a feeling that they realized, because at a certain stage, I'm pretty sure that NTT, the Japanese side of things, didn't know if we were part of a scheme or not. I mean, they didn't know who we were. But I think when they saw that we'd pushed this thing to trial, they realized that we were quite serious about settling this thing in a proper manner. And then we were approached by representatives of NTT, and we settled. So I must say that our dealings with NTT, without the protagonist getting involved, have been normal business. You know, there wasn't anything untoward. It was obviously hard negotiations because it's all about money in the end, but we understood what their position was. And Graham and I, quite frankly, at the end of 3 years, were quite exhausted. We just said, let's just settle at this point of time. And we did. That was a fair settlement, I believe. So we are happy.
And had the management buyout gone through, in other words, had NTT not blocked it, and the protagonists then became the owners of Dimension Data, which what had been proposed, what might have been the consequence of that as far as your court action's concerned, Jerry?
Well, you know, I don't know. I really don't know. I think when NTT put the MBO on the shelf, it's my opinion. I think the protagonist decided that they would, as the judge said, they would carve out certain assets which might or might not have included our lease, but it certainly included the golf course, the artworks, and the campus data center. Simply because the campus data center, these things produce a lot of cash flow. And essentially, they would have financed the MBO and or the LPs, the limited partners in the fund, because 13 million rand a month finances 1.3 billion rands worth of finance. I mean, just as a rough figure. So, but that's my opinion. I mean, I don't know what the inner workings were, and we weren't privy to it. All we know was that eventually NTT said, we want to settle. Japan wants this off the shelf. They don't want to be fighting this kind of battle when they've got bigger fish to fry on the other side. So, you know, we're just small guys. We didn't want to get involved in the whole thing until the judgment came out. And I said to Graham, we've been vindicated. What we said right from the outset was the truth. And we understood, we didn't understand in all its niceties what was going on. But we said all the way along, in fact, we said it directly to their legal team in one of the board meetings. We said to them that there's something funny going on here. And I actually made a comment in one of the meetings that it was ironic that the very people NTT were suing for fraud were the very same people we were negotiating our lease with, at least initially. And this had caused the court case to arise. And I said to them, how can you not see the similarities between the two? That the same parties you're fighting with are the same parties that we get ridiculous emails from and ridiculous claims. And we're still not sure who was involved and who wasn't involved. I mean, it's subject to speculation, and I don't want to speculate at this point what it might have been. But our opinion from the start was that there was something funny going on when they started renegotiating this lease. The judgment now tells us that it was all coming together at the same time. The MBO was put on the shelf. And I think my opinion is that the limited partners then decided to carve out various assets. I'm not sure where our lease stood in that buyout, where it stood. But they were obviously pushing for a very low value, as was Steve Nathan pushing for a very low value for the campus. He was pushing for a very low value for our data center. So I can only presume or surmise in some way that they'd found a method of capturing a very lucrative cash flow at a minimal value. And that, Graham, that's really our story at the end of the day.
Why did you guys fight this? There are most people, most small businessmen would say, I know that they've got much deeper pockets than I have. They can tie me up, as he threatened for years, to go to the right up to the Constitutional Court. Why did you fight this lawfare?
It's about telling the truth and integrity. You've got to stand up to what you believe in. And the lies that they sent in the affidavits, they're blatant lies. Even their legal guys, they said to us, they will never, ever agree to this, what is in the lease agreement. They will never. And I looked at them and I thought, well, you know what? We're never going to give up either. You know, there's sometimes in life you've got to draw a line in the sand. And Jerry and I just decided, not this time, my friend. We're going to, if whatever it takes, it's going to take us. And look, I do admit that sometimes our legal fees per month put huge strain on the two of us. It was huge. Just to try and keep a big legal team up and going, it was a full-time job. But it was, we knew they were just telling blatant lies, lie after lie after lie. And the Steve Nathans of this world, the phone calls I took from him, threatening. And I thought, no, you can't threaten people like us. We're just small guys wanting to come to an agreement, you know. So, yeah. So, I must say, yeah. As Jerry said, we get too emotional. But what they did to us was not right. It wasn't right, you know. And the thing is, they're still renting our buildings. So, you know, they're still there, and all these guys are gone, and they've got bigger problems to worry about now.
And the lesson for other small business people who lawfare is not just, it's not just attacking you guys, Jerry. You aren't the only people who've been screwed over by a big corporate. What is your lesson then to other small businesses who find themselves in a similar position?
Look, I think for me and Graham, this was a unique situation. If I could have warned anybody about Graham's reaction, I would have said the one thing you don't do to Graham is threatening. In any way, because it turns a switch in his head, and he dragged me along with it. I think the important thing is to make sure that your initial lease is watertight. And one shouldn't think of, as a small businessman, one mustn't think of it as, it is a marriage, but you actually have to think of your lease as if it was a divorce. And then be very careful about how you word things. Go over it. Make sure that your wording is correct. Of course, in this particular case, it didn't really help because there may have been a gray area, but that was sorted out as the court case proceeded, as the legal proceedings proceeded. We started realizing that they were certainly manipulating the terms of the lease in their favor, and unfairly so. And and then the other thing as a small businessman is you have to stay on top of it. If you leave it to your attorneys, you won't succeed. The attorney is never as invested as you are in a court case. You are the one that knows it intimately. You are the one that can read between the lines and inform them. They don't always listen to you, by the way. They think you're a nuthead. And trust me, our attorney on many occasions would just put the phone down on me because he thought I was nuts. And they're fighting a legal battle. You're fighting very often an emotional battle. And the two don't often mix. So you have to become, quite ruthless. You write a lot of letters, even if it's to yourself, to get over the emotions, and then try and look at the facts of the matter and try and get as many facts together that support your claim rather than start ranting and raving at an emotional level. And I think Graham and I did that quite well.
Graham, and what have you learned from this?
Well, I've learned that, you know, it all comes back to my training as a soldier in the Rhodesian light infantry, where we were taught never surrender. Even when you have no chance of surviving to the following day, never surrender. So I learned that lesson very well. And, you know, so for me, I just couldn't give up. I was prepared to go do whatever it takes to get the justice that we deserved. And, I don't know if I'd want to do it again. I must say, it's sometimes emotionally it's taken a huge strain on my life. And, you know, but now I'm just trying to move on. Hence, you know, that's exactly what we're trying to do. And I think it's not something you want to take on all the time. So whenever somebody threatens that they're going to take you on and the courts, they've just got to understand that there's no shortcut. It's going to be a long haul and it's going to take a lot of money. And that's all I can think of at the moment.
Graham Roy and Jerry Komnenos, the co-owners of the RandView Data Center, giving us an insight into how business really works sometimes, and certainly another aspect of the very controversial judgment by Denise Fisher, Judge Denise Fisher, where she named the protagonists, the co-founder of Dimension Data, Jeremy Ord, and a number of those who were very close to him. And the way that she described their operations is what sparked Graham and Jerry to approach us and say, but hang on, we had something very similar. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.